Hello there, and welcome to History Rocks. This is a special episode. It comes on the back of an email from one of our History Rockers out there, Amina. Amina has written to me to ask, firstly, if I could make a prediction on 1C and 2Q. 1C being the Tudors, 2Q being the American Dream, I think. Unfortunately, Amina, my crystal ball is not working today. I am so sorry that I can't make a prediction. In fact, these exams have been created so that we really can't predict the papers at all. But I do wish you the very best of luck in your revision. But what she has also asked is, could I do something on the civil rights period between 1945 and 1980? And I thought, well, why not? Why not do something on that? I can help you there. So this episode is going to give a bit of an overview of some of the hot topics on the civil rights topic between 1945 and 1980 for all you 2Qers out there and anyone else who is interested in an overview of the African American civil rights movement. So I thought I will go about this actually looking at the presidents and what they were doing during the period, because that might be helpful to you. And of course, we'll make reference to other groups and movements and issues and things like that as we go along. So how about that? All right, so we're going to start then, I think, with the presidents during World War II. Right, okay, let's start with World War II. World War II is absolutely important to the African American movement, essentially for two reasons. One, quite a number of African Americans signed up to the army and fought heroically defending the USA abroad, and that, of course, should be noted. Whilst they were fighting abroad, they, of course, came into contact with Europeans who did not impose segregation or repress, blacks living in their countries or anything like that. And, their treatment was entirely different to how it was back in the USA. So this led to actually what became known as the Double V campaign, Victory at Home and Abroad. And what they were basically saying is that we are fighting lots of fascists in Nazi Germany and the rest of Europe. But really, we ought to be also fighting the fascists at home. We should be demanding change and insisting upon the enforcement of the amendments to the Bill of Rights, the 14th and 15th Amendment. So it was important in sort of triggering another movement, I think, particularly during World War II. And I think it gave rise, it gave some momentum to another movement that emerges from the mid-1950s onwards too. So that's very important. I think also what's important is that there were a number of African Americans as a consequence of World War II that moved northwards, and they were taking up jobs in munitions factories and things like that to help during the war effort as, you know, white men were drafted into the American army. And they, of course, made a massive contribution there too. But what it also meant is that they were more able to exercise some of their rights now they've moved away from the South. They could register to vote without the same level of obstacles placed in their way. So, you know, you probably know about some of the voting qualifications and things like that that were introduced into some of the southern states. It also meant that they weren't faced with de jure segregation that you often saw in the South. So, you know, not being able to sit in particular places on the bus or in the cinema or in swimming pools or public parks or things like that. In the North, they didn't really have laws to enforce it. That's not to say, though, that this didn't occur, but it was more de facto segregation rather than de jure. So for instance, de facto means like in reality, de jure means by law. And in reality, you might only be able to afford to live in a certain district. There will be shops and restaurants that would have signs in the windows turning blacks away, for instance. There was discrimination in some of the employment practices that were enforced. So we shouldn't see the North as some kind of utopia for African Americans. They faced grievances and struggles there, just different often to those in the South. Now, during World War II, we've got two key presidents. We've got President Roosevelt, who, well, frankly, I don't think did a huge amount to propel African Americans forward. We do, though, get an increased number of black federal employees, I think it went up by about four. In his period in power between 1933 and 45. So the number of black federal government employees quadrupled during that period. And then he also set up the Fair Employment Practices Commission, which I think he did in response, really, to that famous African-American activist who we should actually note here. I think he's overshadowed by Martin Luther King way too much in African-American history. Philip Randolph. He threatened a march on Washington if he didn't address the issue of discrimination in employment practices from the government. And so, yes, the Fair Employment Practices Commission was set up to monitor that. So there we go for him. Not a huge amount of change, really. I think those are probably the big ones. President Truman... again, makes a little shuffle forward in terms of, what he was prepared to do for African Americans. We still never got that anti-lynching law, which we were looking for. Eleanor Roosevelt campaigned on that quite heavily, actually, but we still don't get it. We do get some changes in terms of the army, though, with President Truman. We saw the Navy desegregated first in 1946, and then we see the army being desegregated in 1948, I think. However, it took a little time to work through that. It wasn't really until the Korean War where you got those final units actually desegregating. There was an issue of compliance. There were still some issues with some units just before the Korean War. But nevertheless, you know, you might say, well, that's a positive step. The cynics would say, well, he's only doing it in order to win over the black vote ahead of that 1948 election. Cynics would also say that he's only doing it because it makes for a more effective fighting unit during the Cold War, you know, and that's the thing that actually took precedence. You might also say that perhaps he's doing something on this issue because of the Cold War. Here we are fighting for freedom and democracy abroad, but yet we are not, giving freedom and democracy to all its citizens at home. So perhaps a little humiliation there helped. During this period, then, we see some steps forward, but a lot of issues still to be dealt with. And that's not going to happen really until the 1950s and 60s. Okay, so we're now getting into the period after World War II. And generally, this is known as the sort of Cold War era. The Cold War really sort of, as you probably know, listening to our podcast, emerging from 1945 onwards. Now, generally speaking, it's said that the Cold War was not particularly conducive to the civil rights movement. And it's largely because of this sort of fear and McCarthyism and things like that that emerge, where they equate protest and, you know, with socialism and that, of course, with Stalin. Even W. Du Bois, who was now well over the age of 40, was accused and charged with being a foreign agent, even though there was no evidence to support any of that at all. So consequently, I think the Cold War atmosphere in those sort of 10 years or so after World War II was really important in preventing any significant advancement in African American civil rights. Of course, the NAACP continues to campaign, and we should note the triumph that they had with the Brown decision of 1954. I mean, Thurgood Marshall and all of those who managed to argue the case, it should really be noted. But generally speaking, you don't see a continuation of the campaigning during World War II, you know, with Kaur and Philip Randolph and the Double V campaign and all of those sort of things. It kind of dies down for a moment. And that's why I'm saying I think the momentum that happened during World War II, it doesn't reemerge until the sort of mid to late 50s onwards, I think. So what happens? Well, we've got President Eisenhower, who's in power, and he is credited with, I guess, three main things during this period. One, he appoints Chief Justice Earl Warren to the Supreme Court. Okay. However, he does describe this as the biggest damn fool mistake that he ever made. So that's a bit of a problem, isn't it, really, when you think about it. But the appointment of Chief Justice Earl Warren is absolutely significant, because it's under him that we see that momentous decision of Brown 1954 that overturns the Plessy against Ferguson principle that was established in 1896. Plessy against Ferguson said that it was constitutional to have separate facilities as long as they were equal. So it's this principle of separate but equal. And that then was picked up in a number of cases following that, for instance, coming against the Board of Education, for example, that establishes the principle of separate but equal in schools. And that's been the case now all the way up until 1954. And basically, Earl Warren said, well, you know, they're separate, but they are not equal. We are not equal in providing provision to these young black people. And if anything, it's labeling them and it's giving them a sense of inferiority. And he follows that up with Brown too, that basically said that desegregation of schools needed to happen with all immediate speed. And this kind of leads to a snowball of favorable decisions there on in. And of course, again, we need to credit the NAACP and the caseworkers there for the momentous work that they did. But, you know, Bowdoin against Gale, for instance, following the whole Montgomery bus segregation thing, Boynton against Virginia in 1960, which basically outlaws, I think, desegregation on interstate travel. So all of these cases are absolutely critical. And I think without the Supreme Court helping the African Americans along, they would never have gained as much as they did during that period. And the other thing that Eisenhower is credited with then, other than the appointment of Earl Warren, is the Civil Rights Acts that are passed in 1957, I think, is the first one. And then he follows up with another one, I think, in 1960. They are really, really tame, though. And it's not, though, I guess. I guess it's not all his fault. They met with a huge amount of opposition within Congress. There was this man the Senate known as Strom Thurmond, I think, on the 1960 Civil Rights Act. And he spoke for over 24 hours trying to filibuster the bill. and it got watered down then by Senator Lyndon Johnson in order to get the bill through. Now, these bills of 57 and 60, they're important because they are the first civil rights acts for over 80 years. So that's significant. And, you know, it does try to bring in a new civil rights commission. It allows judges to make special appointments of those who would help blacks, for instance, during voter registration. It brings in criminal penalties for any kind of mob action against African Americans. But all in all, it only increases the number of registered voters by about 3%. So it's not, on the scale of things, that significant. So he's credited then with the appointment of Earl Warren. He's credited with the 57 and 60 Civil Rights Acts. And finally, of course, is his involvement in the Little Rock issue, wherein, of course, he sent in troops to ensure that a number of African-American children could attend the Little Rock High School, despite, of course, the objections from the local governor there, Orville Faubus. Now, yes, it is true, he does, and he ensures that they are admitted into school. The cynic, though, would say that, he did this because of fear that it would spill out into civil disorder. And we see some early signs of that, don't we? And there's some very famous photographs, of course, of some of that going on outside the school. So for him, it was important to show that he was in charge, not Orville Faubus. He was in charge, and he was going to prevent any civil disorder on the streets. So I think a mixed bag, really, for Eisenhower. He certainly attracts some controversy, but nevertheless, of course, he's in during a time when the civil rights movement itself begins now to hot up. And of course, the first instance being the Montgomery bus boycott, when Martin Luther King is invited to speak as a new Baptist minister. And the boycott of the bus company, of course, leads them to back down and desegregate buses in that district. And of course, the Supreme Court cases following that, enforcing it. So that was significant, of course, for them. We should never take away from the Montgomery Improvement Association, though, who arranged all of the carpooling and things like that that went on, and raised money, of course, to keep the process going. And, you know, all of the young men and women that would walk to work rather than get on the bus as a matter of principle. Martin Luther King was involved, but an awful lot had gone on even before he turned up. You know, we shouldn't take away from them their important contribution. Right, okay, so we need to be moving on then. We need to be moving on to our next presidents. Okay then, let's turn our attention to President Kennedy. Now, I think, and I might be wrong here, and feel free to email us in on hello@historyrocks.co.uk if you think I'm wrong, but I think Kennedy gets credited with way too much when it comes to the civil rights movement and just generally. And I think it's in part, it's because he was assassinated and died early. He said a lot and boasted a lot about how he was going to improve, you know, things just generally within the USA. And that kind of included the civil rights issue. You know, he was voted in with a lot of enthusiasm. The African American vote was important in that it was a very close election, this one. But really, I would say the first years of his presidency, he doesn't really do much at all. particularly, I'd say, up until about 1962. So what does he do? Well, when he comes in, he actually appoints some judges who are pro-segregationist in order to curry favour with the southern states. One example would be this chap called J. Robert Elliott, who was an American district judge. And in 1962, he actually issued injunctions against any kind of protests by Martin Luther King and others in Albany. He was an out-and-out segregationalist, and it was Kennedy who appointed him in the first place. So, you know, from the outset, he seems to promise a lot, but not necessarily deliver, and his choices there in order to try and keep, you know, support from some of the southern states. He's doing this, of course, to try and maintain his office, but this is actually damaging to the African American civil rights movement. The Freedom Rides, of course, were particularly eventful during his time in office. He was annoyed at John Patterson, who was the Alabama governor, who, after initially claiming he had everything under control, he later goes on to say that he couldn't guarantee the safety of the people who were involved in that Freedom Ride. And there's only about, I think, 21. It grabbed national attention because these people were set upon and they were attacked during the course of the Freedom Rides. And remember, the Freedom Rides are testing some of the decisions of the Supreme Court to see if they'd be carried out on about segregation on interstate travel. Now, whilst all this is going on, and of course Kennedy feels like he has to get involved, and basically he ordered the end to segregation in interstate travel through the Justice Department regulations in 1961, we do know that there's some evidence that his brother, Robert Kennedy, was actually prepared to do some deals with some of the southern states in a bid to try and control some of this mob-like behavior, some of this bloodshed. So I think that with Kennedy, a lot of this is not that dissimilar to Eisenhower. He feels that he should only intervene if there's an issue of law and order. He crazily even said that he could sort out sort of segregation in federal housing projects. And he said, quote, at a stroke of a pen. And African Americans were so frustrated that he hadn't done this, and actually in protest started sending loads of pens to the White House. Hundreds, thousands of them were turning up at the White House each day in protest of the fact that he hadn't delivered on his word. So Kennedy really, certainly for the first half of his presidency, I don't think should be credited really with any key advancement in African American civil rights. He's reacting, he's responding, and he's not that different to Eisenhower. Yes, we do get the momentous Civil Rights Act, or the Civil Rights Bill, at least we should say, because of course he was assassinated before the bill became an act. And this is on the back of what was going on in Birmingham. Now, this is one of those protests that, of course, Martin Luther King was involved in. King was criticized for this because of his use or his reliance upon, you know, young teenagers at this event. Bull O'Connor was really setting upon dogs, water cannons, beating these kids up. It was captured on TV screens and, of course, in a newspaper. And it's because of this, and because of Martin Luther King's brother being firebombed during this event, that he decided, or you might say it pushed Kennedy into drawing up some kind of, you know, comprehensive civil rights bill. And this is, of course, the bill that ends segregation in public places. But it takes Johnson, you could say, and it takes his assassination, perhaps, to carry this piece of legislation through Congress. welcome back. We're moving swiftly through each of the presidents in our exploration of the civil rights period, 1945 to 1980, and now turning our attention to Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson, of course, is infamous for his promises of a great society. And this was his catchphrase, a bit similar to the New Frontier under President Kennedy. Great society basically brought in a raft of changes, a raft of social changes. So, for instance, we have a major education act in 1965 that gave federal funds straight to localities. We get the introduction of scholarships, for instance, subsidized fees paid for low-income families. We've got the introduction of Medicaid for those who just couldn't afford any kind of medical insurance, and Medicare, of course, for the elderly. We've got lots of new things being opened up, you know, culturally, things like museums and things like that people can go to. There were measures brought in to tackle pollution within the US society. So there were restrictions, for instance, on like things like car emissions. You had Clean Air Acts and things like that. Federal payment of goods and services to the poor were increased, for instance. So a bit more money going in there. And all of these projects, of course, do help African Americans in a sort of roundabout way, in an indirect way, because of course a lot of the poorest in society would have been African Americans still in the 1960s. So that's certainly something that helped. His biggest contribution, though, of course, was making sure that that 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed. And I think he does this largely through, I guess, using the death of Kennedy and insisting on the fact that this is something that he would have wanted as leverage to Congress itself. And he does do that with a level of skill, of course. And he's had to use, you know, a lot of his charm, I guess, to persuade members of Congress to back it. But nevertheless, it does go through, ending, of course, segregation within the United States. Although you could say it takes an awful long time. The majority of the schools were still desegregated by 1968. It takes a long time for that to happen. He also passes the infamous Voting Rights Act, which is really, again, quite critical to increase the number of African Americans registering to vote. And, you know, it sweeps away all of those voting qualifications that we mentioned before. So, for instance, you know, that you had to pay the poll tax, or you had to own property to a certain value, any kind of education tests or things like that are now classed as unconstitutional. It's not straightforward in its passage. It took a long time to get through, and it took some, jiggery-pokery, I guess, with the legislation to get it through. But nevertheless, we do get it in. And of course, this does lead to not rapid increase, but an evolution in the number of people registered to vote within the United States. So I guess, you know, reasonable contribution to the issue of African American civil rights. The one thing that usually gets said about Kennedy and Johnson is like, oh, well, they would have done more had it not been for the Cold War. And it's like, well, come on. Surely we can say that with most US presidents. They like being at war. They're always at war. So you can always say, oh, they were distracted by war, regardless of which president who's, you know, that's in office. I don't think that's fair, really. I think that's a bit of a cop out. I think with a lot of the presidents, you might say their hands were forced or they're pressured in some way to actually deliver. Nevertheless, Johnson begins to lose support because of his involvement in the Cold War, particularly Vietnam protests and things like that beginning to move quite a lot then. If you remember, there was quite a lot of criticism of the American involvement in Vietnam from some sections of the African-American community as well, including the famous boxer Muhammad Ali, and of course Malcolm X during this period too. So he has a reasonable record, certainly better than perhaps some of the earlier presidents, on the African American issue, but perhaps could have done much more too. Okay, we now need to have a look at President Nixon and President Carter, which are the last two presidents in this civil rights drama that we've been going through today. Richard Nixon is a bit of a puzzling one, I'd say, because he will claim that he'd done all sorts of things to advance African Americans, and arguably, I'd say he didn't. So, for instance, he would say that whilst he was president, the number of African American entrepreneurs increased during his presidency. He spoke about black capitalism and bringing in measures that would help African American entrepreneurs succeed in their society. So, for example, he noted that minority enterprises receiving only $8 million worth of business through government contracts by 1972, largely through an office called the Minority Business Enterprise, they were receiving $242 million. Okay, so he's saying that the level of sort of government loans and things like that going to black-run businesses during his presidency increased significantly. He also said, for example, that the number of tax receipts from businesses owned by African Americans went up during this time. So somewhere around $4.5 billion in 1968 to just over $7 billion by 1972. So he would say, well, look, you know, black capitalism was working. And it demonstrates his commitment to, helping African Americans. He believed in hand ups rather than hand outs. So he was saying, you know, you're not helping people by giving them welfare and things like that. You're just making them dependent upon it. It's better to use this money and support these people, you know, that are setting up businesses and things instead. In addition, whilst he was in president, the number of schools desegregating continued whilst he was in power. So we've got about 68%, I think, were attending segregated schools in 1969. But by the time Nixon left office in 1974, it's about 8%, which, you know, you can say is an improvement. Now, I think a lot of that's not really to do with him, though, per se, but it's to do with Congress itself, who introduced this concept of sort of busing African Americans. So literally putting African American students on buses and transporting them out of the area to schools where there are, you know, white students or a predominance of white students. And I think that had a lot to do with the decrease in the number of segregated schools whilst he was in power. I think also you can say that, the work of other organisations continued during that time, which was important in pushing forward African-American civil rights. And of course, the Supreme Court made some important decisions regarding the use of affirmative action, which is, again, not really something that Nixon was happy about, but it was something, a strategy that Congress seemed to adopt, whereby you would help African Americans into certain jobs or into schools, sometimes using quota systems, but sometimes using other things as well. So, for instance, in schools, you might reduce the test scores that they need in order to attend that school. Carter was not that much better, to be fair. He does start off actually sounding like he was against the idea of desegregating, but as time wore on, he does help a little bit, I would say. He does increase the number of blacks and Hispanics to federal courts, for instance, whilst he was in power. He also tried to help minority-owned companies get a fair share of federal government contracts, for instance. He also increased powers of the Justice Department to make sure that, voting rights were enforced, and also that there would be equal employment opportunities commission that was strengthened during that time to make sure that they were fighting against job discrimination. Anything else? Well, we get a few challenges actually from the Supreme Court during this period on the issue of affirmative action. Bake against the Regents of University of California, for instance, was a major challenge to it, where basically they were ruling against some of the practices of affirmative action. Anything else? Well, not really. I guess, there's a slow movement, a slow improvement in the number of African Americans entering certain professions, an increase in the number of black middle class during the period, the number of African Americans leaving with, college diplomas increased during the period. But it's still, by the time you get to 1980, there are still issues for African Americans in urban areas, ghettoization, drugs. The number of African American unemployed was still higher than white college dropouts. There's still lots of issues outstanding. But nevertheless, under Nixon and Carter, some improvement, but I don't think their contributions is perhaps significant as Kennedy and Johnson. Certainly not for Nixon, I don't think. Perhaps a little better on the record for Jimmy Carter. Okay, in the last episode or segment of today's episode, I just want to think about the role of some of the African American civil rights leaders during this period and sort of movements generally. The thing I want to focus upon most is this issue with Martin Luther King. He does get an awful lot of the limelight when it comes to the issue of African Americans. And I guess my thoughts are, how deserved is this? Now, don't get me wrong, Martin Luther King can certainly be credited with a lot of things during the civil rights movement. He was clearly a courageous man, clearly a man with great oratory skills and charisma. And he, of course, was spearheading quite a number of the key protests during this period, including, Albany and Birmingham and Montgomery and things like that. It, absolutely, no doubt that he had an important role. I think he had an important role in perhaps bridging some of the different groups and organizations that he was able to talk to the NAACP, who were notoriously cautious. And of course, their main sort of method of campaigning was through legal challenge, but then also being able to talk to SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that became Student National Coordinating Committee. His ability to sort of navigate those different organizations, which I guess would have alarmed each other, looking at the different aims and methods that each of these groups adopt, that was very important. I think part of that, of course, was his commitment to this idea of nonviolence, although that does attract criticism of him from time to time, that he was seen as too accommodating to local authorities at times, backed down and prayed on a bridge when perhaps he could have carried on and continued the campaign. But the concept of nonviolence, I think, certainly initially was something, an umbrella term that everybody could get behind. And that's something that he can be credited with. I think also for Martin Luther King, because of his strong oratory skills, he was very good at manipulating the media. To describe him as nonviolent, I guess in some respects, is not entirely accurate. He wanted violence, but he wanted violence being meted out by local leaders, particularly, you know, for example, Bull O'Connor during the Birmingham protests. That was absolutely perfect. Bull O'Connor walked straight into Martin Luther King's trap. By doing that, by setting the police dogs upon the kids and things like that, it attracted national attention. This is the thing that really, grabbed the headlines. And of course, the number of Americans now owning a television has increased exponentially. This is why, you know, the Vietnam War is known as like a television war. So because of that, then, they are getting scenes of such protests into the, you know, the living rooms of white liberal America, and they are backing then the African American kids in the protests that they're involved in. And where it doesn't work is where the local authorities back away and they don't use violence and they just enforce the law. And, you know, you see that for a number of the campaigns it was involved in too. So those things, I think, you know, are certainly important. Of course, he's credited with the passage of the 64 and 65 acts, as well as, of course, for instance, his involvement in Montgomery, etc. Where it falls down a little bit is after those acts are passed. Those are actually quite easy to achieve, if you think about it, because all you need to do as a president is sign a form, sign a paper. You know, desegregation is now illegal. Poof, there it is, it's gone. When it comes to things like discrimination in workplace, issues to do with pay, issues to do with poverty, issues to do with housing, those things are a lot more complicated and actually really require federal government to put their money in there, you know, sorry, put their money in it, or, you know, put their hand in the pocket, pull their money out to pay for these initiatives. And when King was involved in like the Northern campaigns, the poor people's campaigns in Chicago, for instance, and things like that, he really didn't succeed. He didn't manage to persuade people. He wasn't as well known in the North anyway. I think he underestimated the level of prejudice in the North, but he really didn't have a clear strategy about how he was going to win the issue in the North either. And this is why a lot of his campaigns over social issues are not particularly effective. I think, whilst this being said, you know, certainly is important, I think the thing that would upset some is the fact that his contribution seems to overshadow everybody else, that, you know, Montgomery was not one individual. It was a very, you know, established organization of people there that were campaigning for change. That Philip Randolph had a key hand in the March on Washington, because it was meant to be a march for peace and jobs. You know, let's put that there too. When it came to a lot of the protests, the criticism, there's a man called Peter Ling who wrote an article. If you Google him, Peter Ling, you'll find an article that he wrote some time back that alleged that Martin Luther King was a bit of a sort of hit and run activist, and that he had a bit of a messiah complex, and that he, you know, liked attracting the attention of the media, going in as if he sort of led the campaign and then leaving the town once the campaign's over. So the suggestion is that a lot of the protests were taking place regardless of him. You know, all the sit-in protests and things like that that were occurring, Woolworths, you know, Freedom Rides, all of these sort of things were coming from grassroots young student campaigners who, and especially members of SNCC, who didn't want to be seen as like a kind of youth wing of the SCLC. They were doing this themselves, and they would resent often the way King was sort of, you know, come in with his media frenzy and take the credit for it and then leave. So there were actually, because we always talk about unity when Martin Luther King, I guess, is at his peak. But there are still quite a lot of divisions within the civil rights movement that we should pick up upon too. And don't be afraid to criticize King and criticize his record during this as well, because it's like any individual, any human, he deserves to be looked at from all angles. Equally, when it comes to Malcolm X and Black Power and Black Panthers, they often get maligned, don't they? And yet, you know, these people played a significant role in shaping Black identity in the North. They allowed it to be okay again to wear, you know, clothes that they would associate with Africa or revert back to their African names or wear their hair as an in an Afro style. It was fine to do that. It was celebrated because Black was beautiful, you know. So that is something that that whole movement brought back into focus. There's a documentary on the Black Panther Party that is still available, I think, on YouTube. It's worth looking at. I'll try and find the name for it shortly. But it really did go through the whole history of the Black Panther Party. And they're quite interesting alone, because everybody just thinks of them as running around the streets, you know, with weapons, being all militant and threatening police and so forth and having gunfights in the 1980s and so forth. But the Black Panther Party did play a significant role in local Black communities in the North. You know, they would have soup kitchens, for instance. They would have sickle cell anemia clinics. They had, drove ambulances and made sure that the kids were clothed and things like that. So on a day-to-day, the Black Panther Party actually played an important role through its survival programs in helping African Americans in the North. So go and have a look, actually. If you look at, you know, if you're wanting to go off and watch a really good documentary, I would recommend the documentary known as Vanguard of the Revolution, The Real Story of the Black Panther Party by a chap known as Ron Pascal, I think it is. It's on YouTube. It's an absolutely fantastic documentary, and I think it will really explain the appeal of these groups and the appeal of Black Power in the North and why they were important. And, you know, there was no Martin Luther King equivalent in the North. The issues in the North were very different. Martin Luther King was not somebody that they identified with. He was middle class. He was, you know, a Christian. He was talking about segregation, which isn't, and things like that, which voting registration, which wasn't, it didn't resonate with them. Their issues were different and social and complex and to do with, you know, grievances in the workplace and prostitution and drugs and poverty and all these other things that he wasn't talking about. So go and have a look at it. Rethink some of the things that are said about each of them. I think it's really important that we keep an open mind. So I'm going to sign off. I do hope that, Amina, you found this a useful little exploration of the civil rights issue. It's maybe given you a few things to think about and take away. I wish you the very best of luck for your forthcoming exam. And I salute you. Farewell.